Hello, everyone. This is a Scientific Sense podcast. My name is Gil Epen. My guest today is Reinhold Wiegelaers, who is Professor of Managerial Economics, Strategy and Innovation at the KU Leuven University in Belgium. She's also a scholar at Bruegel in Brussels and at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Reinhold.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. So I got a few of your papers here, and I want to start with your 2021 paper, Funding Risky Research. You say here, the speed with the COVID-19 vaccines were developed and their high performance underlines how much society depends on the pace of scientific research and how effective science can be. This is especially the case for vaccines based on the new designer mRNA technology. We draw on this exceptional moment for science to reflect on whether the government funding system is sufficiently supportive of research needed for key breakthroughs and whether the system of funding encourages sufficient risk-taking to induce scientists to explore transformative research paths. Yeah, so this is a topic of great interest for me. So, you know, I have some background in the commercial arena in R&D funding and R&D research. And the whole world knows now what happened in COVID-19. There were a lot of resistance on the research early on. I believe in 2014, 2013, the technology was developing, but not much funding. And something happened to the world, and then, you know, everything sort of fell into place. So your thinking here is how should the government funding system think about risk and return for research funding, right? So what do you find here?
Yeah. So if we really start first from where we were when the COVID epidemic broke out. So at that moment in time, we were actually pretty very fast in being able to develop several vaccines, but particularly the mRNA vaccine turned out to be really the winning vaccine here, because it could be very easily scaled. It was very effective, efficient here, and also very easy to modulate here. And this technology was really completely novel for developing vaccines, is mRNA technology here. In the end, very often you hear that, wow, we were really very, very, very good in being able to respond to that challenge here. But if you take a look at this, we were actually pretty lucky here. Why? Because at that moment in time, yes, the mRNA technology was sufficiently ripe, but had never been applied to a vaccine or a drug here. So it was really the first time. So in that respect, we were really very lucky here. And we were also lucky that the mRNA technology at least was already sufficiently developed in 2019 that it could actually be used so effectively for the COVID vaccine. And that also was a very bumpy road in order to get the mRNA technology so far that it was ready to be developed by the commercial sector. The bumpy road really also was partly because of, at a very early stage, because of the science funding, which really was very risk averse here, because as long as this the mRNA technology, because it was so disruptive, so novel, was actually considered to be really too risky. And as long as there were no concrete already preliminary results, science funders didn't want to really fund. And the story of Carico is a very well-known story here, how she got all of her research proposals never get funded here. It was really a coincidence that she met somebody that was equally enthusiastic about this and could actually share some of the other funding that he had in order to fund this here. And they were lucky then to get a scientific breakthrough. And then the next step into technology, their DARPA was also really able to really pick this up as a potential idea. But also there, the big pharma companies So they joined the project of DARPA, but also realized this is too risky. We drop out at that stage. There's only a small number of small startup companies that really took this on board to further develop, which was very complicated because still was a lot of failures of applications that they looked at here. But sufficiently progress had been made to get to that platform, but with a lot of risk aversion here, and only it was because of a few individuals that really persisted and that could convince a few funders here. So it was not really something we could take for granted and where we can really say, oh, next time it will be again, we will be again having luck. So that's why we also looked more systematically into, is there indeed a risk bias in the science system here? And the results that we got from there, we measure risky research as research that's more novel, so that makes new combinations. Now, of course, not so there is also other type of research that could be risky here, but novel definitely is more risky. If you make new combinations, that's where you get potentially really big breakthroughs with the new combinations. But since it's new, it could also be risky here. And what we indeed find is that those so researchers that produce more of these novel research here, they are actually way more likely to not get funded here. And so if that's the case, if there's systematic bias here in that respect, and we found this for our research that we looked at the ERC grants, but others have also looked at NIH funding. So this risk aversion definitely is there. And it's also confirmed by the case evidence that we have, like for instance, with the Carrico case as well. She sent us her comments that she got from the referees here, and they were all saying too risky, it's a very nice idea, but too risky, no preliminary results, we cannot we cannot fund this kind of thing. So it's all very consistent.
Yeah, so I was thinking, Rangel, so this is from a government funding perspective, different agencies, you mentioned DARPA and NIH and others. This is a portfolio.
The DARPA is an exception. So these are one of the research funds. Because they were willing to, but there the big companies dropped out. But they go for the high gain, high risk. It's one of the few exceptions.
That's interesting. Yeah. So, I was going to say it's fundamentally a portfolio management problem. So you don't have infinite resources. So you have constraints on dollars, space, time, and money, and people. Yeah. People constraint is also quite high. Yeah. So from a government perspective, or even from a commercial perspective, I have some background in pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. The problem to solve is sort of maximizing the portfolio of investment choices. Exactly. And so the question would be, how do you do that? So, there are correlations among these investment choices. You know, some have deep tails, as you say here, if it hits, it has huge returns. So how should the government be thinking about that portfolio maximization problem?
So we indeed looked at, first of all, what could be potential reasons for this bias here. That's, of course, because a lot of funding agencies, they need to really deliver short term here for the political masters that they're serving here. And that means you because the risk is really, you only get to the high returns in the longer term here, and with a high risk that nothing comes out too. And so if you want to go for a certain immediate return, you have to avoid risk. So that's definitely one element here. Also, we saw also peer reviewers are very often also risk averse because they don't like what's disruptive and what changes their usual way of doing here. And then we suggested also, so it's really fundamental in the system. So it's funders, it's evaluators, it's also researchers themselves, because if they know that there is this risk bias in the agencies, they will be less likely to propose things that are too risky, because they would know that they would have a higher failure rate there. So it's in the whole system here, that risk bias. And then the question is how to deal with that here. Of course, you could give a clear mandate to the research agency, like DARPA has, it can go for high gain, high risk here. But one of the things we also suggest, and it's what you also hinted at, is that we should really look at this way more as a portfolio. So not looking at an individual project, is this good or not? It's really looking at the whole portfolio, and in that portfolio, allow for enough room for these more risky type of investments here. So developing programs that really would be focused on the high gain, high risk, and making ensure that these programs and the projects that you support there fit within a portfolio here, and that would also be a way to deal with returns that you have to generate for your masters here, because then as long as you as you manage that portfolio well, you get enough average returns here, and once in a while you have the big hit and can afford to also get a lot of losses on these high gain, high risk type of programs here. So managing is a portfolio, but very often the big science funding agencies, they don't look at this from a portfolio perspective. So right. It's really, they have individual projects that they are assessing here. And so peer reviewers, they evaluate individual projects or projects within a certain area, but they don't have the overall view here to evaluate this.
Right. So I haven't really thought about this, Rainil. So one thing that you mentioned is this 4-year or 5-year horizon problem the politicians.
Yeah.
And in the commercial sector, we also sort of have that problem in the sense that, you know, CEO lifespan or options expiry, stuff like that, right? So all these things sort of go into this decision-making process, this portfolio management problem. So even if they understand the portfolio, there are still extraneous constraints that may not allow them to make the right decisions, it sounds to me, right?
Yep, indeed here, because also certainly the type of companies that we looked at, like the startup companies there, very often the founders do have that vision here, but they of course need to also find the resources to be willing to fund their projects here. And so they have to convince the financial markets here. Even within big companies, they also have to find and motivate their returns here. And if there is a risk aversion on the financial market side, then you have the same kind of bias that could play in there. And the bias again can come from stock markets, which wants short-term or not long enough, don't take a long enough horizon. And as I said, for the high gain, high risk, that really means taking longer time here in order to be able to recover this riskiness here. And you only see after a very long time whether something becomes really a hit here. So you really need to have a longer term perspective here. So stock market is very often too short-term oriented here. But so even, we also looked at this more carefully, even the VC markets also have some kind of risk aversion too here. Although in principle this is risk capital financing, right? Yeah. But very often you need also to have isolated cases of VC investors that are really very close to a certain project, can really assess also that particular project, and they might be willing to. So that's much more angel investors is what we see. They really other VCs. VC companies that had already experience were entrepreneurs in similar or closely related markets here, and they are willing to take that still higher risk here. So even among VC investors, there is a risk bias. And if that's the case, then that really is an extra barrier for the high risk. And in general, that's also what you find in the research, is that the fact that we're really talking about high gain, high risk, so this could really be big breakthroughs, but with a small probability, right? And so in general, people really, when it's something comes with a very small small probability, that's very often then put to zero. If it's too small, it's equated with zero. And so even if it's a big breakthrough, but too small probability, it gets and the rest of us. And yeah, that's all in general. So it's
it's really interesting. So there's a diversification problem here, really. So you know, so if you think about a large pharmaceutical company, what we find is that only about a quarter of its stock market value can be really assigned to known products, which means that 75% of the stock market value is related to options the company is pursuing.
Yep.
So it seems that the market understands the optionality in large portfolios where there's not diversification. So they don't, they're comfortable with that. But in the venture capital, private equity arena, the diversification is not very high. And so, you know, they are looking for their bonuses or the next round of financing, that they cannot take too much risk. So I wonder if there's a sort of a distinction between sort of venture capital, private equity players compared to very large portfolios of big pharma, for instance.
So these are all very good points. So of course the size of the portfolio help you to diversify more and to take on board more risk here, and if VC companies are smaller, have a smaller portfolio, then of course indeed they can take less of that risk here. But that's also where we compared EU versus US markets. Here in the EU, most of the VC companies are very much more smaller. They go for and that's why they can typically only go for first and second rounds, but not later rounds here, so they can only go for the early rounds. But in the US, at least, you also do have bigger VC companies that can actually also really work with larger portfolios, and they can also take on more risk here. So that definitely is also an advantage for the US markets here. If you say big pharma also has bigger portfolios, bigger pockets and bigger portfolios. And on top of that, they also have also other advantages in the sense that they have complementary assets. So they know how to, they have the experience on how to run clinical trials. They also can benefit from a lot of economies of scope across these different projects here. So that also allows them in principle to take on more risk here. So definitely, there are reasons why big pharma could take on more risk. But the other thing is that a lot of these risky things, like I said, come from novel type of research here. That's very often very disruptive type of technology here. The mRNA technology is a good example of that, since it's basically chemistry and it's not bio. That was a completely different way of developing here. And that also meant that you needed different skills, different ways of producing, of thinking about this technology here. And that disruptiveness is, of course, also something that actually goes against big pharma here, because their advantages are very often on the incumbent technologies here, and they actually may be less familiar with the new, more drastic and radically new technologies here. So even if they would have bigger pockets, they might still actually also be more risk averse here because of this disruptiveness nature that can go in two ways. Why they would like that less is because they're less familiar with, but also if the disruptiveness means it kills whatever they have already as a winning element available here, they would have less incentives to do that here. So that goes against.
So size.
And they will only be and they will only be willing to go onto that new drastic technology when it's sufficiently clear that the technology will come on the market here, and then it's better to be on the boat rather than to be hit by the boat.
But size. So the way that I was thinking about it is not quite right. Size is not a good proxy for. So suppose I sort of look at risk aversion against size, then NIH should be a big outlier because they have a huge portfolio. They have all the diversification in the world that you want to look for. But we're finding them to be pretty risk averse. Then is it really the political constraints? Or what exactly is causing this risk aversion in grant money?
Yeah. Yeah, so I already tried to go into that here, but let me go back. Indeed, so indeed they have a big size here, but they don't really look at it from a portfolio perspective, right? So they have a big budget. They allocate this for the different areas that they are in, and the different programs here, but they typically don't manage that enough as a program. So in that respect, it's size, but once every program is decided, it's pretty small, right? And it's within that those programs here that you lose a bit the size of how you can play then with risk here. Another disadvantage also is that the peer reviewers, so it very often relies on peer review here, and we studied that quite some detail within the field of the economics of science. And peer review, there is definitely also a kind of risk bias. Very often, again, as I said, because a lot of that research is novel, is disruptive, and it's that therefore also very often not so familiar with the peers in the field here, and they might be also a bit more risk averse here in the sense that we don't know whether it will work or not. It's something new, we don't know. and then if you have to make a choice of something that's pretty clear that will deliver, then maybe you would go for that as well. And on top of that, of course, if there would also be then from the agency perspective, again, like I said, the short-term deliverable as well.
Also, it sounds to me, Reinholz, correct me if I'm wrong, it also sounds to me that it's an incentive and segmentation problem. As you say, the projects are small, the portfolio is big, but nobody is looking at the portfolio. Everybody's looking at the projects.
Yeah.
And project-level decisions are going to be highly inefficient if you don't understand the portfolio that you're pursuing. So do you think, is that the issue at large government?
Well, it's part of the issue. It's, I mean, like I said, the problem is really systemic. so there are different elements that play along here, but that definitely plays an important role. Another important role is that the way in which the panel also very often takes a decision. That's very often, so you are with several peers and you have to come to a consensus, right? So then we know if it's a consensus that it will go to averages here, and the ones that score on the extremes here also averaged out. So that averaging and trying to find for consensus is also something that goes as a bias here. There has also been tried alternatives to that, like for instance working with golden tickets, that individual researchers can actually, if they really like a project, they can go with a golden ticket, and whatever the others say, this would be selected here. So that's getting a bit out of that consensus building that also would lead to the risk aversion. So there were several dimensions here that play along. So it's not easy to, there is no silver bullet that will change it. You need to really affect all the, because also some, so like for instance, NIH, but also ERC, so they also do have these programs where they say, okay, we really want to go for these high gain, high risk type of projects here within a certain program. But even in those programs, they sometimes have a hard time being able to fund the risky research because the researchers are less inclined to submit a high gain, high risk type of proposal, because they know overall in the system there is this risk bias here, and it also selects researchers into going for the easier and the safer research avenues here. And they do, so, if they would do any high risk, high gain type, they would do it on the side. But go for the so when they apply for funding, go for the safe type of projects.
So it sounds to me, I want to put words into your mouth, sir, but peer review and consensus-based decision-making may not be the most efficient allocation process. Mm-hmm. We don't typically have this in commercial organizations. It is a little bit sort of top-driven, you know, especially at the high-level R&D funding. Not that they're going to be right, not that the top execs are going to be right all the time.
Yeah.
But they have a lot more power in commercial organizations to drive things. And consensus is not something that they have to really seek, right? So this would be a very interesting case study. Is it the consensus process, let's call it more broadly the democratic process, that is biasing research funding toward more mediocre, let me call it, projects? Yeah.
Average. It's nicer. So definitely for most of the science funders, they work with this peer review and with this consensus type of models here. But as I already said, DARPA is an example that goes in the other direction, which is willing to go for the high gain, high risk, is because they partly have that in their mission, but it's also partly in how they make decisions on which projects to support and how they support this here. And so although they also do rely on reviews from experts, they don't rely on a consensus here. So they just absorb all the different reviews here, but then they still, it's the individual policy officers that know how to work with that information, but don't need to average and come to a consensus here, on the contrary. But that means it's really very important. Who you pick as a policy officer, because those kind of policy officers that manage these projects, they really have to be very entrepreneurial, willing to take also the risk here, and in a way that actually they have enough technological expertise to assess that risk here in a good way here, so don't get trapped into path dependency, have no incumbency motives here, but also are still sufficiently at the frontier to also really interpret the riskiness here and what could be good.
Is DARPA's hit rate any better?
Yes, but I mean, hit rate, if you say how often are they successful, the nature of the project that they're dealing with, they have a high failure rate, right? And that's a reflection of the high gain, high risk perspective that they take. So yeah, the question is, what do you take as the benchmark, right? Because then of course they will have a lot of failures, but that's exactly also what should be there, because if you go for this high gain, high risk, there is a high failure rate, right? It's right. What you do and what you do with that failure rate too. How quickly do you learn it's a failure, and do you stop it, and do you switch to something else?
So I want to go into another paper, more recent paper. Do funding agencies select and enable risky research? We talked a bit about that. But evidence from ERC using novelty as a proxy for risk taking.
Yeah.
So this is quite interesting. So here you say concern exists that public funding of science is increasingly risk averse. We talked about that. Funders have addressed this concern by soliciting the submission of high-risk research to either regular or specially designed programs. Little evidence, however, you say, has been gathered to examine the extent to which such programs and initiatives accomplish their stated goal. So this is from a European Research Council. It's a European perspective. So what do we find there in the data?
Right. Yeah. So the reason why we looked at the ERC is because they really have it in their mission to go for high gain, high risk here. And so we thought, okay, that means that indeed they should definitely not have that risk bias. So let's have a look at whether that turns out in terms of who do they select, and if they get the funding, also whether that allows the researchers then to also do the more risky research. Because the way in which it's designed is also, it gives a big amounts of money for a long time. So it's for 5 years, it's up to $2.5 million, which is quite a lot here. And that also allows normally to take more risk because it's big amount of money and it's a longer time perspective. So it should also allow for more risk taking. That's also why it was designed like that. Mm. And in terms of the selection, it was also very clear, because it was admission, that in the instructions that the peer reviewers got, that they really got the instruction, you should go for the high gain, high risk. And that's how you have to evaluate these projects here. But it was still peer, it's still peers. but the peers, the panels could also decide among themselves how they would decide. Would they go for consensus, or would they go? So they could get all the autonomy how to decide on that. Overall, what we find was actually that in the selection, there is definitely, but of course, the question always is, how do you identify high gain, high risk research, right? The problem is we didn't really get the proposal, but we got, so we knew who had applied, and we could actually look up what's the profile of these researchers, what experience that they have in the type of research that they already produced or not, because that profile really is something that's been evaluated in the selection. So what did this person already do in order to assess whether this would be a good researcher to fund. So what we found was if researchers that applied had in their profile way more of these high gain, high risk type of novel research, that they actually had a lower success rate here. And that's even if they would have high, also just highly cited papers, excellent papers. That's for sure, you needed excellent papers, highly cited papers in top journals. You definitely needed that. But if you, even if you would have those, if you would on top of that do the more novel one, you had a lower success rate than somebody that would only do highly cited papers. So even for the highly cited, that take that risk, they also had a bias compared to if they would not have done these highly risk. So that's what we found. And that was particularly also for the younger researchers here. So there, the peers were really much more risk averse here for younger researchers. You really needed to prove, and you should not go into the highly cited, to the highly risky research. That's what we found here. But we have to say that we are still struggling a little bit in the field to identify what risky research actually is, and even what novel research actually is here. So we use publications, and then we use the characteristics of those publications to identify novelty here. But we're still trying to figure out how to measure that more. And there's a lot of development going on. We're using now also large NPL techniques to really look at the content of the research here to identify novelty here. So I have to say we're still making progress on that research here. So it's not yet that we already have very consistent and robust findings here. We're still trying to figure out good ways of measuring this.
Yeah.
So but the direction seems, so what the findings so far seem to suggest, maybe there's something we need to look at more carefully.
So I'm thinking from a researcher's perspective, you know, I could think of this sort of a citation portfolio maximization problem. Mm-hmm. And let's say I have 10 papers out there and I got only 10 citations. I'm making this up. It's 100 citations. So my score is 100. And I have, let's say, a very, very risky thing that I did. Mm-hmm. Failed miserably, no citations, and I spent a bunch of time on it. And so from a researcher's perspective also, this is sort of an incentive and economic maximization problem, isn't it?
But the way in which we measure it is it's not by the output, it's really by the novelty. So it's really ex ante, right? And certainly for young people, I mean, they usually, they don't yet have citations anyway. So we looked at, as long as you made new combinations or had new things in your, so you had a higher likelihood to go for the really breakthroughs, but also higher likelihood for failure. But we didn't measure the failure. We measured the novelty, right? So, and then, even if those would get, so the problem also is that this novel research typically doesn't get published or is a lower likelihood to get published in really the top journals here, because top journals also don't want to take the risk and they also want to go for the ones which have a much more certain impact in the short term. Very often also because they really are competing on impact factors and these impact factors, they are typically measured with citation performance in short windows. And so they also bias against, and that's why also you have this bias in journals. And that means that if you really have a novel research, you're less likely to get in the top journals. And that also, again, is something that very often is used by peer reviewers here. So they look at where did you publish, and Yeah, if it's not the top journal, that gets biased against here, even if on top afterwards you would have a highly cited paper. But if it's not in a well-known journal, highly cited journal like Science or Nature, it's less likely there. That also biases against you as well here. So that respect, even if we don't look at the citation outcome, but really more like the kind of research in which journals, and those are the indicators that we also do see that panel members are using very often to evaluate proposals and people applying.
So there is some sort of a structural problem, if I understand this correctly.
Yes.
So
yeah.
If you say top journals are also looking for safe papers, then
Or papers that really would give, safe papers in the sense that a return in the short term.
Yeah. Return in the short term.
So not average ones, so they really want to go for the big hits, but the big hits immediately. And that's where you don't take actually the risk, because the risk is really very often is breakthrough in a longer term. That's also what we show these novel papers that we have identified. They are more likely to become breakthroughs, but it takes at least 3 to 5 years, and the journal impact factor only looks at the three first years. So you're missing all those breakthroughs.
So I don't know much. I'm not an academic. I don't know much about this, Angel. So, but it appears to me there's scope for some sort of a journal that looks at, let's call it high risk, long term possibilities, very high failure rate type papers, because all the journals that we know and academics publish in. They don't typically do that because there is a risk to their reputation in some ways. And this is what happened to mRNA technology.
No, it's true. Because when they actually found this, they also had a hard time publishing their results in the top journals here, and they had to publish it in a field journal. It was a good field journal, immunology, but it wasn't the top because they had the same kind of bias here. So what you're suggesting is indeed that we would also have journals that would where these kind of high gain, high risk type of papers could really land. So if we, from talking with some of these top researchers that do that high gain, high risk type of research here, what they usually say is, if I have this kind of really novel type of research, I don't even send it to these top journals like Science, because I know it will be, I know which kind of journals that it will land in, and these are not the top ones. These are just exactly the subtop, but I don't care.
There are some already, you're saying.
Yes, then the problem is indeed because if they publish it then in the lesser or the subtop type of journals here, it also will get then it will take longer before it will be recognized here. So having these journals would work, right? But it still would face the barrier that you have in the science system in general against risk. Because if it then gets published in these specific journals, other researchers might be much more risk averse in taking this up fast enough here. So it's really a systemic problem here, and you cannot just by handling one. It has to affect the whole system.
So that sort of leads into your other paper. How fast is a novel technology going to be a hit? Antecedents predicting follow-on inventions. So we can think about this in technology terms, but we were just talking about in terms of papers.
Yes.
So there is a sort of a conventional sort of S curve here, and so if you have highly innovative research but you cannot get into the top journals, you go to the second category. It's going to stay there for a while before the takeoff happens. Just like in technology, right? So I mean, I wondered. So let me just read this. So despite scholars' high interest in identifying inventions that have a big impact, little attention has been devoted to investigating that drives how fast novel technologies embodied in these inventions are reused in subsequent inventions. So to overcome this limitation by empirically identifying novel technologies, mapping their reuse trajectories, and examining the characteristics of the novel technologies affecting trajectory shape. So the So the classical S curve, you know, you have sort of the initial period of time, you're not doing much. There's heavy lifting there because the inventor or the innovating researcher in a university have done something really interesting, but nobody reads it, nobody sees it, it takes a long time, and at some point it starts to take off. But that period of time it's quite long sometimes. That will kill companies, that will kill innovators, that will kill careers of researchers. And so there's a systemic problem there too, right?
Yeah. So when we looked at this diffusion, we looked at patents, which is somewhat different than publications here, but actually it's the same kind of idea that you could develop in for publications too. So in the end, if this would be novel, they would have a higher likelihood to have really big impact, but it might take a long time because of the aversion in the system here. That's why indeed also there we find typically S-curves here. So initially these novel ideas don't really take off, and then it really takes some time, and then if enough people are adopting this, then of course you get a higher diffusion. So we have it something very similar in publications as we have in patents, but in publications there is still a bit more systems effect here, because it matters where the publication has been published here, in which kind of journal. That's what the potential user is also use as a way of, do I adopt it or not, and when do I adopt here? So this scientific community is somewhat different from a technology community here, and I think there is, although we still have to check that further, is I think there is more risk aversion bias in the science system than there is in the technology system here.
Wow.
Because
okay.
The technology community, so the science community, they know each other very well, so they really very often rely on who are the top peers in my field, which are the top institutions, the top journals. In the technology environment, that's a bit less so. I think they also know which are strong countries, but still there is way more contestability in the system, I think, and that makes it, I think, also more open to take risk here. But even in the technology area, we do find also this same S-curve, so that for novel ideas initially it takes some time, and then it's only once enough others have adopted then the technology. But what we do find is that if these novel technologies really have a strong science base, that then it takes even longer before you actually kick off. But these science-based novel new technologies, if they once they kick off, they're also way more likely to have a much bigger impact, because their impact can be way more broader across many more different technology areas here than if the novelty would be not science-based here. So the science-based, again, when you add the science-based within the technology dimension, it also makes it a bit longer before you get the impact, but also, again, in the end, a higher potential, but you have to wait longer.
You have to wait longer. So I'm just thinking here. I haven't really thought through this, Samuel. So large companies, you know, as you mentioned, their shareholder value constraints, top exec options expiry constraints, may have certain decisions to make, and they may sideline. So I'm talking the commercial sense here.
Right. Yeah.
They may sideline innovative ideas or innovative research that might take longer to fruition.
Yeah.
So if we have more frictionless markets, so I want you to sort of contrast EU to the US here.
Yeah.
If you have more frictionless markets, then those guys can go out and, you know, try to do some stuff on their own.
Yeah. Yes.
But if you have a lot of constraints on that, then you will kill innovation in the larger economy, right? Is that happening in EU?
Yeah, I do think so. A very important factor that really also makes it much more difficult for European inventors that take these more risky type of projects, they need to convince also financiers, right? And if the financial markets, and certainly the risk financial markets, are smaller, are less experienced, and have don't have the scale to really take on board these larger risks here, then it's much more difficult for these companies to find somebody willing to fund theirs. And so that kind of smaller scale, more fragmented venture capital market, it definitely works against an entrepreneur in Europe. That would actually be sometimes also argued that we would have less entrepreneurial inventors that are less willing to take risk. I'm a bit more optimistic on this, but what definitely is also something that has to be taken into account is that in the US the market is so big that you can take a risk, and then if you fail you can start again because the market allows you to re-enter again. And so a lot of the entrepreneurs have also a lot of experience in taking risk, and that's also an important element. The venture capitalists also have more experience in taking risk in having failures. And in Europe, since it's way more smaller, the market, also a lot of our entrepreneurs, they only have one project. They have to really win. And if they fail, the market is too small to restart again here. And so they also have less experience in taking risk and dealing with failure. The entrepreneurs as well as the venture capitalists here. So. It's a systemic issue.
So we have this concept of intrapreneurship in large companies in the US. Mm-hmm. So we take a group of people, and you know, we are visionary execs. So not many companies do this, but yes. If you're visionary execs, you know, they can take a group of creative, new idea people, put them together into something with a different set of incentives. And you mentioned this, it's not just the quantity of investment, it's also horizon problem, which is, so suppose I say, if I am the CEO of a company, I say, hey, you guys go do this for 9 months, that's not going to work. I have to give them sort of a long time horizon to try things out, right? So this idea of entrepreneurship has happened in some companies in the US. Do you think the large European companies are doing that as well, or is anything going on there?
Yeah, so I know also examples of companies that have really, and European ones, even Belgian ones, which really have worked on very drastic innovations, but really on the side, right? So that's how you typically do this here. It's against part of your portfolio. You have to have enough projects where you get a return here, and that allows you, again, to work on to let some of your researchers to work on these drastic other type of projects, fun type of projects.
The moonshot.
So again, it's a scale that you would also need in that entrepreneurship here. And also, I think a kind of experience in how to run the company as a portfolio, where you have really this mix of really these more disruptive type of projects within the portfolio here. So you also need companies that have the experience on how to manage a portfolio where you have these risky type of investments here. And then still there is always this issue of, if then that disruptive technology succeeds, but it's really disruptive of what you are producing in your main cash cows, it still requires also a business perspective of how are we going to then develop this disruptive, killing our cash cows that we have. So how are we going to do that transition here, and that's where very often incumbent firms also fail. Like, for instance, Philips is one such example with ASML. This was something that could have been nurtured within, but then they decided nope. And then even if they nurtured it initially here, once it became a bit more clear and had some deliverables, and it realized that that was something really drastic, they decided to let it go because it was too drastic from what they were doing here.
Yeah, so I want
to entrepreneurship could go, but it depends on.
So I want to go back into the policy arena. So we see a lot of inefficiencies in organizations like NIH and NASA, for instance. Mm-hmm. Is it because the decision makers don't have the right skills? You mentioned they don't look at the portfolio context. Mm-hmm. Commercial companies do that reasonably okay.
And
so do these organizations have to be restructured, redone?
Yeah, so yeah, it's a bit of a chicken and egg problem, right? So you get the skills for the kind of organization that you have designed, and how do you change it now? So I'd like to think that we need to start changing by giving different KPIs to the organizations. From a policy perspective, you have to have really clear KPIs that you give them. You say, this is what we want you to do. But at the same time, also allow the research, so the people with these KPIs, to have enough autonomy to really develop their own, but accountability, right? So KPIs for which you are accountable, but with these KPIs also allow for another degrees of freedom to operate in this, because the kind of entrepreneurship that you would need requires that independence here. So accountability and independence, that's what you need to combine here. And if you offer that kind of very clear KPIs with a lot of independence and, of course, good conditions in terms of wages, but also the freedom to operate, to really work with interesting people and bring ideas to market that make the world a better place, those are then the kind of environment that you can actually offer then to attract the right kind of skills here. But the problem is once you have skills, how do you change an organization, right? Because they will try to look for the KPIs that match their existing skills. So that's why I think that the change has to come from outside to impose these different kinds of KPIs and different kinds of characteristics of the job that you would actually offer to attract the right kind of skills.
Should they change their compensation structure? Should they be more based on options?
Yes, but allowing the individuals to take these options here, is that what you mean? So, and that they that's also what I mean with the KPIs, right? So is KPIs should actually also be seen as more within that option perspective as well here. So it's really clear KPIs that allows for a lot of risk taking to take place here. Yeah.
No, so I mean, if NASA and NIH administrators' compensation is not salaries, that is what typically happens in the government organizations, but they have more of a commercial type compensation
yes.
structure.
Yeah.
Do you think that will improve the situation?
Yep.
Tough to say.
I think what also matters really, it's not only the monetary compensation, is also what is really the type of projects that you're able to contribute to, and the results of those projects here, being able to bring the next big hit into the market. And that will pay off also later, because most of these policy officers, they don't stay there forever, right? So in the end, they will go back to the market. And if they can say, okay, this is the kind of expertise and experience that I've built up with, what I have contributed, I think that non-monetary returns are also very important here. So tying your results with some sharing in the returns here, it's a bit tricky, because of course we are talking about highly risky type of returns. So it's only
there's
very
a horizon.
Small.
There's a horizon issue.
So then you have to compensate with the horizon. Yes, exactly.
Excellent. It's very interesting research in health. So,
I mean, there's still lots of questions there, but I think it's really interesting questions, and it's a nice. So I hope also with this podcast that maybe we can induce more people to work to look at this here. So.
Yeah, I mean, it is what's going to save us. I mean, there's all sorts of diseases happening. I'm going into the mRNA thought process here. There is, a lot of risk on the war front and all sorts of things going on in the world.
Yes.
That if you sit back and fund research that is less risky, you're going to be cooked.
Yes.
It's sitting in hot
No,
water,
no, no.
right?
Yes, because I'm also
Yeah.
looking at climate
Yeah.
change and green tech here and there. I see exactly what you're describing here, because so we've waited too long and now it becomes a bit more urgent. And now you see policies really, yeah, we have to work with technologies that are close to the market, right? But and that's fine. We should definitely do this. But on the other hand, we should not forget that there are still big breakthrough ideas that could really be the game savers in the future, and those we need to support now as soon as possible here, because it will take a longer time here. So we have to find again this balance between high TRLs that are close to the market, but also never forget these big breakthroughs here as well. And they need long nurturing here, and for that we need to start early enough in the process here to support them.
Absolutely. Excellent. Yeah, I know
Absolutely.
that you have to go. So yeah, thanks so much for
You're
spending time with
welcome.
me.
Yep. Okay. Yep.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.